the House Rules Committee to order. We're going to go a little off the order just because we have a couple rules here. One, when we have representatives that come and go and have to get back to their other meetings, we try to call on them as quickly as we can. And we have a couple here to testify. Is Debbie Boone still here? Yep, there we go. Okay. So we're going to start by opening a public hearing on HJM 22. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator, and we can have the representatives come up forward if they would like, and anybody else who they want to come with them.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. HJM 22 condemns acts of violence based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and other personal characteristics. Calls on public institutions to remain vigilant against such acts of hatred. Requests passage at the national level of the Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act, otherwise known as the Matthew Shepard Act, or similar legislation to aid state and local jurisdictions in investigating and prosecuting bias-motivated violent crimes based on race, religion, color, religion, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. On March 22, 2009, Damson Deal and Kevin Patterson, who were visitors to this state, were attacked in Seaside in what has been classified as a hate crime. This memorial is a response, at least in part, to that incident. Oregon has several laws that are sometimes called hate crime laws. ORS 181.550 mandates reporting of crimes motivated by prejudice based on perceived race, color, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, marital status, political affiliations or beliefs, and other related categories. ORS 181.642 requires training, identification, and reporting of such crimes. ORS 166.155 and 166.165 deal with criminal penalties for acts of intimidation based on race, color, religion, sexual orientation, or national origin. The Oregon Equality Act, Public Law 100 from 2007, defines sexual orientation to include gender identity and amended ORS 166.155 and 165.
Thank you very much. And however, whatever order you three would like to proceed with. Okay, that's a perfect order.
We'll just go down the row, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44.
Talk right into the mic so the people in the back can hear, because it doesn't seem to quite pick up.
How's that?
That's
a little
better,
closer. There you go. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for having us here before you today for House Joint Memorial 22. You know, in the course of the session, you know, we start off the session and we think we know which bills we're going to look at and what memorials and resolutions, but every once in a while, things happen during the course of the legislative session that we, as elected leaders, should be responding to, and that's what you have in House Joint Memorial 22, responding specifically to an incident that happened in March on the coast, act of violence that's being considered a hate crime. And I know there are folks out there who believe that we don't need any designation around hate crimes, but when an act of violence occurs against individuals or groups of individuals based on their personal characteristics, it has a chilling effect on those communities, whether it's communities of color or, in this case, the gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community. I think the really important parts of this memorial on line 7, I think reiterating what we as Oregonians value, and that would be, whereas no one should be targeted for assault, intimidation, or harassment of any kind based on race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, national origin, citizenship, marital status, age, or disability. And then further on line 21, and be it resolved that we call on all public institutions to remain vigilant against acts of hatred based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and other personal characteristics. Very important statement, I think, that we need to make, and I'm hoping we'll be able to move this memorial quickly. And it also supports, urges Congress to pass the Matthew Shepard Law to make sure nationwide we have stronger hate crime protection for all of our communities. And with that, I'd like to pass it on to Representative Boone. And
we'll
urge your full support.
Yeah, we'll hear the full panel, and then we'll have some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Deborah Boone. I represent the upper left coast in which Seaside is located. This happened in my district, and it was very disconcerting to me because I can't tell you how many people I urge come to my district, and especially to Seaside, for spring break, because it has a long reputation of being a fun place to go on spring break. This whole thing is exactly what Representative Kotek has talked about. This is a hate crime. I find it intolerable, and I am so glad that this House Joint Memorial 22 was brought forward to address this, and hope that you'll consider it. Just a couple of details of this attack. These were very young men, nursing students from Seattle, 22 and 23. One had health insurance, the other did not. And being nursing students, when they did come to, they were beaten unconscious on the beach late at night and left to die, basically, because the people did not call for help. They were found by others. They knew when they came to how bad their injuries were. They had severe head trauma. One of the victims' right eye was so badly damaged that he's had to go to a plastic surgeon. This is just, again, unacceptable to me, and I know to all of my colleagues here in the legislature, and I hope that you will pass this out quickly. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Berger, do you want a question? I know you have to leave fairly soon.
If you wouldn't mind. I'm a little discomforted, not by this memorial, but by the fact that we are reacting to an incident that I have no personal knowledge of. I only have testimony that a couple of guys in Seaside said they were attacked. Okay? There has been no sort of due process in this. I have no personal knowledge of other than their names in here. And I guess I like the idea of this memorial, but I don't like it as a legislative reaction to a single incident, if that makes sense to you as reps. Would you just kind of respond to that? Would it, without the mention of this incident, wouldn't it carry as much weight as anything else, or is it just a reaction to an incident? Because if that's all it is, why are we doing it?
My understanding, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, thank you for the question. My understanding is that from law enforcement perspective, and though that, as far as I understand, there hasn't been an official ruling on this, but they are classifying it as a hate crime. And I go back to my earlier comments about while it might be one incident, I believe it's only one incident that has frankly been reported or has received the kind of status that really people take notice. I would assure you that individuals in a variety of places in our state feel unsafe on a regular basis by the threat. And so while this might be only one incident that we're responding to, I believe, again, going back to the chilling effect that this has for the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community, to know that this happened in our community, in our state, on the coast, two young men brutally beaten, I think we have to have a response because I think we have to send a clear message. And while I understand your concern about a particular incident, in some ways maybe it is symbolic, but it's a symbolism that we need to react to, and I think strongly. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Please.
Thank you. And you may not know these men because they're from Seattle. They're visitors. We spend a lot of money trying to attract visitors from other states and other areas in our state. And they were targeted. They were called names, et cetera, that indicated that that's why they were chosen to be beaten. And it is not the first time in my community. There are several kids in high schools along the coast who have literally dropped out of school because they've been targeted with hate crimes just like this. Whether or not they're all reported, I can't say. But this is not a single incident. It's all around. And I think it speaks well that Oregon is considering something like this, that to be outraged by this kind of thing. And I think any number of incidents is too many. I find it unconscionable that people would do that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I don't disagree with that at all. And in fact, we've had some horrible high-profile incidents in this state, and you and I can name them, and I think they're unconscionable. I guess this happened in March. I have not seen any police report. I have no knowledge of what happened during that incident, and you're asking us to mention this incident in a memorial. I mean, the bulk of the memorial I couldn't agree more with. I'm fine with it. It's that highlighting something that's out of a police report that I have no personal knowledge of. And what happens if it comes out later that, gee, things weren't exactly as described in the press? Because I haven't even seen any press releases. You know, it's all sort of so new that I'm really discomforted that it's in here. And I think it subtracts rather than adds from the basic message, which is this kind of thing is intolerable in Oregon. I couldn't agree with you more on that. It's the addition of an incident that I'm asked to vote on when I don't know the facts, I don't know what happened, I'm not privy to the police report, and you can come here and tell me what happened, but that doesn't tell me anything other than you believe a terrible incident happened. And we've got plenty of reports of those kinds of press of incidences, and I guess I'd just be more comfortable if this language was a little stronger about what our statement is and a little less about an incident.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, maybe if we could have our third panelist, yes, just because I think they've been more intimately involved in the actual details. But thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Yes, I hope that I will speak to some of your concerns, Representative Berger. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gina Frazzini. I serve as the Executive Director for Basic Rights Oregon. We are a statewide advocacy organization serving the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and allied community. We represent tens of thousands of Oregonians from every corner of the state, and of course I'm here to testify in support of House Joint Memorial 22. The memorial urges Congress to pass the Matthew Shepard Act, which would ban anti-gay and anti-transgender violence and strengthen hate crimes protections nationwide. This memorial was prompted by the hate crime that took place just weeks ago in Seaside. The two men in question, Samson and Kevin, visiting the Oregon coast from Washington State, as Representative Boone has mentioned, were on their spring break, wandered away from an evening campfire when they ran into a group of four strangers who asked if they were gay and then called them fags. Samson and Kevin were brutally beaten and left unconscious on the beach. And Seaside Police Chief Bob Gross told reporters that Seaside Police have, quote, had some hate crimes before, mostly threats, but I've never dealt with anything this serious, end quote. And in preparing for the hearing today, Chief Gross wrote in a letter to a Eugene community leader that, quote, this was clearly a hate crime, and to call it anything else would have been a disservice to the victims and the community. I've attached that letter from Chief Gross to my testimony today, and he would have actually been here to provide testimony and answer some of your questions in person today if it had not been for an unfortunate situation where he's at a memorial today for two officers who were killed in the line of duty in the Seaside area. So he's not able to be here personally. The truth, though, is that Samson and Kevin's case is not an isolated one. It's the most recent example of the kind of violence that's pervasive in our country. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs found that there were over 2,400 anti-LGBT hate crimes reported nationally in 2007. And then in 2007, they saw the greatest number of anti-LGBT murders in 8 years. 21 gay and transgender people were murdered in the United States in 2007. That's more than double the number in 2006. So again, this most recent experience we've had here in Oregon really points to a larger issue that affects gay and transgender folks. And in fact, transgender people are even at greater risk than gay folks. In 2001, right here in Oregon, Lonnie Kai Okoruru was found bludgeoned to death in a field south of Hillsborough. The Washington County Sheriff's Office told press at the time they believed it to be an anti-transgender hate crime. And local law enforcement shared with us at Basic Rights Oregon that, quote, the condition of the body left no question as to the motive for the attack, end quote. Lonnie's murder remains unsolved to this day. As with any crime, the guilty parties aren't always brought to justice, but when they are, we know that hate crimes laws work. Just days ago in Colorado, a court found a defendant guilty of a similar crime, the brutal murder of Angie Zapata, an 18-year-old transgender woman. None of us should be subjected to the violence that Samson, Kevin, Lonnie, and Angie experienced. The Matthew Shepard Act makes it clear that no one should fear for their safety just for being themselves. And in passing HJM 22, the Oregon legislature can lead the way to a safer America for all of us. You can send a message to Oregonians across the state that wherever you live, wherever you work, and wherever you travel, you deserve to be safe. So on behalf of Basic Rights Oregon, I urge you to pass HJM 22. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And I would just add that I believe the language around this most recent experience in Seaside is a way to connect this issue to something that I think has been pretty widely in the news across the state, the region, and also the nation.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any one of you ladies are free to respond. I'm just curious, if someone is murdered, what's the difference in the application of the law if something is designated a hate crime versus just a crime?
Sure. Excuse me. In the case of the Matthew Shepard Act, the Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act that this memorial references, urging Congress and the President to pass and to sign. By designating a crime a hate crime, it acknowledges that the crime was motivated by a bias towards a person's personal characteristics, and it brings additional resources to the law enforcement who is charged with investigating that crime. So the federal government makes resources available. They're available to intervene where needed and necessary, and there are grants associated with with that work to the local law enforcement to allow for for the investigations to move forward.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So you almost have to know who was guilty of the crime before you can apply the hate crime designation?
You have to, Chair and Representative Garrard, knowing who was guilty, I'm not necessarily tracking the question. I don't think in the sense of what you're looking for. I think that there are a lot of... without having charges filed, there are a lot of ways in which law enforcement can identify something as a hate crime, given the circumstances around that crime, which is the case in Seaside. There have not been charges brought.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For anybody, whoever is involved with drafting the bill, this is a question. Lines, and I want to ask about the characteristics that are identified in line 8 of the bill, then lines 15 and 16, and then lines 26 and 27. Those three lists of characteristics are different. Could you speak as to why they're different in different parts of the bill?
I'm assuming one is state law. I'm just not sure which one.
Line 8, it looks like, is a statement of what those who vote for this think ought to be. What that list ought to look like. It looks like lines 15 and 16 speak directly to what currently are against the laws of this state.
That's right.
And then 26 and 27 refers to what ought to be in federal legislation. And so what I'm wondering, specifically, I guess, with lines 15 and 16, current law, that does not include, it looks like it includes race, color, religion, sexual orientation, national origin, but there are other pieces that are not, I mean, am I to understand that these other lists of characteristics are currently not covered under Oregon?
Under Oregon law?
Law now?
Some of those, excuse me, Chair Roblin and Representative Edwards, some of them are covered by non-discrimination, and I believe 15 and 16 is specifically the hate crimes legislation that's in statute here in Oregon, and that and the definition of sexual orientation does include gender identity, although it's listed just as sexual orientation in the hate crimes statute.
Okay. That helps. Okay. And I guess I have... one last
one more question. Yes.
I mean, I guess this it's not a question. It is an editorial. I mean, this type of behavior on the part of the perpetrators of the specific crime that we're relating, that we're speaking to, is so vile and despicable. And it's hard for me as just as a person, let alone a legislator, not to feel such a level of contempt for this type of behavior and these type of people, as that it wouldn't border on hate itself. I mean, to me these victims, not only are they our neighbors and our friends and our family, but they are sons and daughters. And I have two small kids at home, and I have no idea what their future holds for them, but I can say from the bottom of my heart that I don't want them growing up in a state that would not take a strongest stance possible against this type of behavior. And so I'm fully supportive of this legislation and would be happy to help you in any way that I can. So
Thank you.
Any other questions? I have no one else that signed up to testify, so I thank you very much for being here. Is there anyone else that would like to testify? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on HJM 22, and we're going to open a work session on HJM 22. So I'll take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move HJM 22 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I move HJM 22 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves HJM 22 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I remain very discomforted. I have read this sheriff's letter that he claims it's a hate crime. But I think, contrary to the proposers of this, that it, by including this, you basically make it less powerful because it's about an incident, rather than more powerful because it's about how we treat each other. I'll support the memorial with huge reservations about how silly it looks to be reacting to an incident instead of a more bedrock set of attitudes that we're really trying to get at here. I just think that they like it because that language is in here, because it has impact, because it's immediately. I don't like it for the same reason. But I think we're on the same page as to what we're trying to get to here, which is changing people's attitude about this kind of crime. I could make long speeches about crimes against women that have been ongoing for generations, but I won't. And I'll support the memorial with great reservations about naming a specific incident that we have not prosecuted. We don't know who did it. We only know that this sheriff says it's a hate crime, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess I'll make my statement, seeing no one else, before we take the roll. And that's basically the kind of the opposite of Representative Berger. And I appreciate her counsel with respect to a lot of things, to me in particular. But I think that we passed laws in 2007, and we passed other laws throughout the history of our state, making sure that people understand that we don't tolerate these behaviors. But it isn't until an act happens that we remind ourselves that we have to keep vigilant on making sure people understand what we really stand for. And it is those individual acts that force us to act and remind people we already have hate crimes laws, we have others. We maybe haven't pushed the nation where we want it to be, but at least in Oregon we have done things, and that if it weren't for these incidents, we didn't have any incidences ever again because we didn't have any hate crime, we wouldn't be here today having a memorial, because we would all be able to pat ourselves on the back that we're treating each other the way we should be appropriately treating each other. So with that, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Rowland?
Aye. Motion passes, and we'll send it on to the floor. Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, I would like to carry this bill on the floor, please.
And we will have Representative Nolan carry this bill on the floor. And with that, we're going to close our work session on HJM 22. And for the purposes of just taking some testimony, we aren't going to finish up with another bill. We have two representatives that need to speak on House Bill 3104. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3104. and have some people who have to hurry off very quickly. So we'll take these two pieces of testimony, and then we'll go from there. Yes. Thank you both for being here. And we'll give a short explanation. Keep it very short. We'll do a longer one when we come back to this bill later today.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 3104 requires state agencies to add questions on an agency forms and publications regarding the receipt of information about veterans' benefits, declares an emergency effective on passage, and that's as short as I can get.
Okay. There we go. Representative Nathanson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representing House District 13. Last year, the Task Force on Veterans Services had meetings around the state. I attended several of those meetings when they were in my area, and I came away with a lot of energy to work on one thing, just one thing that I had learned about from those hearings, to help veterans and at the same time save some money and bring some federal money into our state. Plain and simple, there are tens of thousands of unidentified or uncounted veterans in Oregon. Many of those are veterans who need services that we can provide or the federal government can provide, and for many, they are not receiving services or they're receiving services on our nickel and we're not receiving the federal benefits. Why? Because plain and simple, we don't even know the veterans who are living in Oregon. The situation is noted in the task force's report. Here's one of their key findings. Quote, substantial amounts of federal aid are unrealized because only 80,000 of 351,000 Oregon veterans identified through the census are in the system. The report goes on to tell us, quote, only 30% of Oregon veterans are enrolled in VA health care. Even with these low numbers, Oregon veterans receive $1.2 billion in federal VA benefits. By not connecting more veterans to their benefits, including education benefits, Oregon is leaving as much as $4 billion of federal money on the table. The task force believes that all state and local agencies should ask if their clients are veterans so that veteran benefits information can be provided. We have plenty of examples where veterans are not receiving services and where we are losing federal money that should be coming to Oregon and circulating here. As you know, as a member of Ways and Means, I've been keenly interested in making sure that we maximize federal dollars coming into the state. We are failing to do so. This bill would help advise our agencies and counties how to help change that, how to turn that around. Consider how hard we work on the demand for funding food banks, emergency and low-cost housing, and health care. Some of our people needing assistance are not receiving assistance, and it could be federal. In an October 2008 on-the-street survey of homeless people in Portland, 22% were veterans and only 5% were receiving VA benefits. I've also been keenly interested in technology projects and the need to do a much better system of collaboration between departments and agencies as we upgrade our information systems. We have overlapping systems, redundant information, and yet here's an area where we lack the information basically. So here we have a task force report that's giving us some advice on how to collect some low-hanging fruit. We need to simply make sure that we do our best to ask the right questions, to provide services to our veterans, and to get the federal support. There's one amendment that I hope you will consider along with this bill. It's the Dash 5 Amendment. It's our very best work and effort to make sure that we have the simplest and most straightforward instructions to state agencies. The Utah Department of Veterans Services and the Utah Department of Motor Vehicles undertook a similar effort to identify veterans who were doing business with the DMV and capture the names to send to the Utah Department of Veterans Services. To date, they have identified about 70,000 veterans who were not receiving benefits. We can do that here, too, and we'll probably do even better. Let's make sure that every veteran counts and make sure we know how to provide services in the best way possible for Oregonians. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm the governor's policy advisor for military and veterans issues. I also had the pleasure of serving as chair of the task force that came up with these recommendations. Thank you for the opportunity to come here today and also moving your schedule and being flexible. I truly appreciate that. My comments today I'll keep very brief. What you see before you in the Dash 5 amendments represents a negotiation between all the different partner agencies, and we believe it reflects the most collaborative, comprehensive approach to having a rational outreach program in Oregon. In simplest terms, we're going to try to make sure that the electronic tool that ODVA has developed is available on all public websites. That's easy to do and relatively cheap. ODVA will be responsible for coming up with, and actually has already, self-addressed or pre-addressed postcards that are coded toward agencies on the DAS coding, as well as counties and other groups that want to be identified, so that it is truly as simple as talking with somebody and asking if they'd like to have additional information about Veteran Services. People fill in their name, their mailing address and email, pop it in the mail, and it goes to ODVA, and at that point, ODVA will work with county Veteran Service officers, Marion and Polk counties, potentially state Veteran Service officers, or potentially National Service Veteran Service officers, if they're applicable, so that that Oregonian gets the best information about benefits and access possible. It also, the Dash 5 amendments includes a sunset, which we believe is important. This outreach program is truly vital to capture the Vietnam-era veterans, because a lot of folks that are now nearing the retirement years may not know what they don't know in terms of benefits earned. And we believe that over the next 4 years, if we do this right, we will be able to capture the majority of the folks that want to be involved. Again, the reason for this is needs to be emphasized. There is an executive order 0909 that is for state agencies only. This bill would incorporate the Bureau of Labor and Industries, as well as other standalone state executive branches, as well as counties. The counties are partners in this approach. We actually have, as in your packet, my written testimony, as well as a letter from the county Veteran Service officers supporting this. I believe Bo Lee is going to send a representative and have a person in favor of this bill. We believe at the end of the day this sends a clear message that all generations, all eras of veterans are worth our attempts to try to reach out and provide them the benefits possible, and we just appreciate your consideration on this matter.
Thank you. Questions?
I guess my one question is, Representative Nathanson, the Dash 5s are also the ones that you would appreciate having introduced to this bill. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Dash 5 would be it.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much for both of being here. We'll let you go on and do your work. We're going to come back to this for a couple of the other people who are here. We had some more representatives that have come and gone, so we're going to open a couple other bills so we can get their testimony and get them on their way as well. So for a quick one, just because I know he's run back and forth, we have Representative Maurer here. So we're going to open, and we'll leave this other one open. We'll come back to it. We're going to open House Bill 2345A to take Representative testimony, and we'll hear a short statement first so we kind of can keep in mind what we're doing with these different bills.
Let me get my statement here. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2345A requires that health professional licensing boards develop processes to deal with impaired professionals, establishes uniform standards for monitoring impaired professionals, directs health professional licensing boards to impose sanctions on impaired professionals, deletes the existing impaired professional programs of specific boards, and applies to licensees identified by health professional licensing boards and disciplinary proceedings commenced on or after January 1, 2010, declares an emergency. It's effective on passage.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Representative Ron Maurer, serving House District 3, which is most adjacent county. I led the work group for House Bill 2345. And what we're not establishing an impaired provider program. What we are do is moving these out of the boards. Currently, there are four or five of these boards that have impaired professional programs. where if a pharmacist, a dentist, a doctor, a nurse has an issue with a substance abuse, that they can take part in a treatment program that is not in the board but associated with the board, but the board is the one that did the monitoring of these impaired professionals. And there have been issues with the provider programs that are embedded in these boards, and this bill rips them out of the boards and makes the state no longer a treatment program, because there was concerns that some of these provider programs, and I'm sure there'll be nodding of heads up and down and sideways if you can read the audience, is that it was interpreted that some of the boards were in fact doing treatment, and that put the boards in a very precarious position, and there were some very public concerns about what the boards were doing. And so what we want to do is have the state no longer be in the business of treating impaired professionals. We want to ultimately and first and foremost protect the public interest, public safety, but we also recognize that these providers, most of them, can be rehabilitated, and in fact society has put a lot of effort and time and money into training these people, and these people have put their lives into a career path that required a substantial commitment. And we have a vested interest in essentially salvaging professionals to the best of our ability. What you have in front of you is not only the bill, the A in gross version, but you also have an amendment, 2345-A6, which addresses some concerns from the Oregon Medical Association and some cleanup language, as well as a concern from the ACLU, and I'm not quite sure if all of those concerns have been addressed, and I'm sure they will come and let you know what their concerns are. Hopefully what we've been able to do with the A6s is address most of the concerns that allows you to move this bill so that we can fix it on the Senate side. This has been a very long and arduous process to get the professional boards to agree, because in fact there are boards that don't agree with what we're doing. And so there is controversy here, notwithstanding anything that I'll say we've reached consensus on. But we also are very cognizant of the privacy needs of the individual, the impaired professional. But as a state entity, these boards have mission number one, which is protection of the public safety, and that cannot be foregone. So without getting into any other detail, I'm going to stop, because I hope you hear from other people that may have concerns on the amendments. But I do not believe that there's anything that we cannot overcome on the Senate side.
Questions? I guess my biggest question is, so right now you would have us move the dash sixes.
Yes, I would appreciate you moving the dash sixes. If it's not, I know it's not the 100% solution. The Oregon Medical Association has a concern, of which we agree. It's just how the sentence is structured. And hopefully the ACLU will also come forth with their concerns, and hopefully we can address those concerns also.
And my understanding is that they have a dash five that takes care of their concerns, that being the ACLU.
It does. I don't know whether the A6 incorporates
the A5s or if they're consistent, because that's
but,
the other
but I'll let them speak for themselves.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And I think we're going to move back into a previous order we had. We'll leave that open and we will ask some people, and I know that at least one of the people has until 4:30 to meet, and we'll get them back. So we will open another hearing, and that one would be for House Bill 2726A, and we're going to open a work session on 2726A, and we're going to invite some other people to come and let us know how they're feeling about this bill with the newest amendments. So if you represent the Restaurant Association, you can come on up. If you represent the spirits or wine and whatever, you're welcome to come on up. And if who was the other group that we wanted? That's pretty good for now. Okay. Thank you very much. And thanks for coming back so quickly.
Always a pleasure, Mr. Chair.
So, invited testimony. We'll hear a short explanation of the bill as it is, and then we're going to hear where our amendments are today. So, short explanation.
Start with?
Yeah.
House Bill 2726A defines restaurant chains as part of an affiliation of 15 or more restaurants in the United States selling standardized menu items and operating under trade name or service mark, and exempt movie theaters, healthcare facilities, and cafeterias. Requires chain restaurants to determine for standard menu items the typical caloric value, trans fats, saturated fats, carbohydrates, and sodium, and make the information available on request in a written format. Requires disclosure of typical minimum and maximum values for combination meals. Excludes menu items and alcoholic beverages offered less than 90 days per year. Requires chain restaurants have a menu, menu tag, or menu board at the point of sale for all standard non-self-serve items, and a conspicuous statement of recommended daily intake of calories, saturated fat, and sodium. Requires that the Department of Human Services establish rules for administration and enforcement of the Act, including a policy regarding caloric disclosure for alcoholic beverages. Allows the DHS to inspect restaurants for compliance and imposes fines ranging from $250 to $1,000 after allowing 60 days to cure. Preempts local ordinances, declares an emergency. There is a -16 amendment that deals specifically with exceptions under which an exception could be established for menu boards serving drive-through areas of chain restaurants.
So with that, Representative Kotek, would you like to explain where we are and which amendments are important to us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for having us back to talk about this bill. This is the Nutrition Information for Consumers and Chain Restaurants Bill, also known as menu labeling. 2 years from now, what we'll see is calorie content next to prices on menus and menu boards if we're able to pass this bill. Essentially, there's a two-tier implementation by January 1 of next year. Chain restaurants, which are defined as 15 outlets nationwide, would provide nutritional information in a readable format, and the bill describes the content there. And then by January 1 of 2011, you'd actually have the calorie information on the menus, menu boards, or food tags as described by the bill. This started off as an attempt to model what is happening in Multnomah County, and because they are currently up and running doing this very same thing right now in Multnomah County. In the course of developing this bill, as you see, we are an A engrossed, and the amendment we'll be considering today is the A24. This bill has been widely worked with many, many stakeholders because it's a very comprehensive and important bill. We want to make sure we get it right. The bill ends up with implementing parts of Multnomah County, parts of a statewide policy from California. It does, and clarifies in the A24s, it would delay implementation of Multnomah County, and the statewide law would have precedence over all local rules and enforcement if we pass the A24s. And let me just speak to those, if I may. First of all, I want to thank the Oregon Restaurant Association and the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance and the other public health advocates for coming to some consensus on how we should put this bill together. In the -24s, you have the addition of some elements in the rulemaking process in Section 4 on page 4. The first one being in discussions with the restaurant stakeholders, it became apparent that there might be some difficulties for certain restaurants in physical locations to be able to meet the drive-through menu board requirements. So the Section 4 addition, starting on line 3 in the A24s, would create a section
It would allow rulemaking, which would establish criteria under which the drive-through area of a restaurant may be eligible for an exception or a variance to the menu board labeling requirements. The criteria would allow for restaurants that are unable to fully comply with the law for their drive-through area to use a modified form of menu labeling. Acceptable criteria for modified compliance shall include incompatibility with local land use or signage ordinances or site-specific conditions making full compliance impossible. So that was an attempt to get at those very specific situations where we might have a restaurant by virtue of, honestly, physical location or local land use laws that would say you can't have a menu board so big in your drive-thru. So that would be allowed under rule under the dash 24s. Also, on the back page of the dash 24, starting on line 9, you see a new section 6. When the Engross was finalized in committee, it wasn't clear on adopting or enforcing. And so this revises the preemption to make it clear that a local government may not adopt or enforce a local requirement for the determination or disclosure of a nutritional information by a restaurant. And just to be clear, that's restaurant, not just chain restaurants. At this time, there's no attempt to go after independent, smaller mom-and-pop restaurants, and we wanted to make that clear in the preemption. The other item in the dash 24s begins on line 11. Became apparent to me that there were some concerns in from stakeholders who deal with alcoholic beverages, beer, wine, and distilled spirits. And although the A and Gross had said these things would be determined by rule, and the intent was to make them match Multnomah County, and I personally don't think we need to have actually calorie numbers in statute, but there were concerns about consistency. So what you have in the dash 24, starting on line 11, is an attempt to clarify and rule the different caloric and nutritional values for wine, beer, and distilled spirits, as well as clarify that if a menu item is alcoholic beverage with more than one alcoholic ingredient, that you would use these actual caloric numbers to come up with your overall caloric amount for that mixed beverage. Also, as you go on to the second page, it retains the language from the A and Gross that talks about the only types of alcoholic beverages are those that have been on the menu for more than 90 days, trying to get at things that are there on a regular basis to eliminate the seasonals. And also, if you're handing someone a bottle that has the labeling on there with the information, you're good. So that's talking about the containers. So that was existing language from the Engross, but just rewritten for this amendment. And finally, because I wanted to make sure some clarity is on the record, I had some discussions with the restaurant stakeholders about the self-service aspects of this bill and what we actually meant by self-service. And so for the record, I'd like to read the intent behind the provisions for self-service items to inform the rulemaking process. First of all, menu items that are for self-service shall be accompanied by a food tag, shall be listed on a menu board that is readily visible from the self-service location or is listed on a printed menu. For menu items offered in a buffet, for example, pizza, chicken, prepared salads, the nutritional labeling must specify the size of an individual serving, so you can understand the calorie with the size, and the nutrition information for an individual serving. And finally, for the self-serve item, individual ingredients intended to be selected by a customer to create a customized salad, for example, in a salad bar, are not required to be labeled with calorie information. And that was important because the self-serve area, you know, it's a little bit of a gray area. We wanted to be clear on that. And I will stop there and answer any questions, but lots in this bill, but we have consensus in the sense that while not everyone is completely happy with perhaps where this bill is, because, for example, the folks in Multnomah County are not very happy about having to put what they've accomplished on hold. I'm not sure all the stakeholders think this is necessary, but this is a good bill. It's been heavily worked. I think we have agreement, and I will leave it up to my colleagues to the right to hopefully say the same thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Perry.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Association. I appreciate the opportunity to get here today. Obviously, we are appreciative of all the work that Representative Kotex and others did on this bill. Just to put it in perspective, where we are, obviously, when you talk about cost for menus and everything else, the more wide you cast that net, the obviously more inexpensive it gets for opportunity cost. And so whether or not we like menu labeling or moving forward to menu labeling, we do see as it's something moving forward. So from our vantage point, I think there's going to be a federal law at some point that is mirrors somewhat of California. So the closer you can get to California will dramatically reduce the cost to our operators. I don't think you're going to see a lot of different from a consumer perspective because California has calories on the menu just like we've discussed. And so we appreciate the work that's been done to take some of the major components of this bill and basically copy California as it relates to combo meals and per serving sizes, which we hope will dramatically reduce the cost to our operators. And if a federal bill passes in that same way, we don't have to change the menu again. And so that was pretty much done in this bill to hopefully reduce the cost. And we appreciate Kotek putting on the record, Representative Kotek putting on the record on this stuff about self-service, because obviously if you have pizza on your menu and your pizza's on your buffet, we don't have a problem listing with that. But there are items that are put there that are not on your menu, and up to the customer from deciding how much they want to take. And so we want to make sure that that isn't not relied on, upon for the operator. And so with that, we are, if you adopt the A24 amendments, that is the last bit that we would like to see. And I would want to address also the point that Representative Kotek touched on as far as the independents. I think at some day and age, independents are going to be included in menu labeling. But when you look at it from a cost perspective, they change materials so often, and there's so much labor involved in finding the information. Until you have a national standard where you have suppliers and distributors involved in the process, it's just not cost-effective for an independent to get involved. So we hope that is down the line as we get into more of a nationalization standard. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions also.
We'll take all three first.
Thank you, Chair Roble, members of the committee. Paul Kosker representing the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, and I appreciate Representative Kotek and her patience in dealing with the issues that we brought to her as late as last Friday and in getting amendments done that incorporate our concerns and address our concerns, and that's true. The A24s address our concerns, and they were primarily to make sure that the work that's been done to get into compliance with Multnomah County was as clearly and concisely stated in the same words as Multnomah County used, so that we didn't have the potential of sort of starting over with a new agency, and she was very helpful in doing that, and we appreciate that. Our concerns are addressed by the A24s. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Gerard.
Mr. Chair, if I may, yes. I would just like to say for the record how much I appreciate Mr. Chuck Taylor and Legislative Council for the multiple drafts and his ability to turn around something from Friday afternoon to today. And there's patience all around here, and I appreciate LC immensely. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noted that this would be for Representative Kotek.
Yes.
The A24 amendments go into detail specifying exactly how many calories are in a glass of wine, how many carbs, how much salt, et cetera. I'm wondering, and the question I have is regarded on page 4 of the bill, line 13, in determining these same values for the food items. It says to the extent the department considers practicable. And since we've gone to such an extent to specifically indicate calories, grams, et cetera, with the alcoholic beverages, why have we not gone to that step for the actual food?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garrard, thank you for the question. You know, I did have a different amendment drafted last Friday to deal with the alcoholic beverages, and in that time we actually, and I want to just sidestep to this, that first, because I had something drafted that said, why don't you look at what the Food and Drug Administration does, which is the one who sets the calorie contents, and was politely informed, in particular for wine, they have many, many versions of wine, and so there was really a need in alcoholic beverage land to make some very clear distinction. I have talked to folks in the Department of Public Health on line 13 about the wording to the extent the department considers practicable. We had talked about taking that out, and their point was they will do everything they can to follow U.S. FDA practices, standards, and rules. They have no desire to reinvent the wheel, but they might come across a food item that might not have been determined yet, and so they wanted at least a modicum of flexibility. And so I do believe most of this should be determined in rule. We have guidelines. I think there's no desire to create some
you know, bizarrely new caloric standards for any of the food. They'll go to what the federal government is doing. They'll look at, you know, calorie databases. We provide where you can find this information. So while I understand the concern of some stakeholders that that's maybe a bit of a might create some concern that there might be inconsistency, I think the department needs that to be able to be fully flexible on, based on what's out there in the marketplace. But thank you, Representative.
Just a quick comment, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. I would feel more comfortable with the bill if it did have a reference to FDA standards, but with your assurance that this will be interpreted in that manner, it's much more agreeable. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, I just want to thank Representative Kotek for all the hard work on this. I have been, as you know, someone who's wanted this kind of a bill, and it's not easy. It's really hard work to get here, and I just want to thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Any other questions? Representative Gelser.
I just wanted to echo Representative Berger. I know that you have juggled many, many different and competing interests, and I'm really pleased that you have a bill that we can move forward. I share the disappointment for the folks that worked hard in Multnomah County, but I appreciate your vision and leadership in making sure that we're able to extend this across the state, and I look forward to working with you to expand this in the future.
Thank you, Representative. I do think this is a strong balance between the concerns of business in terms of statewide consistency and good public policy, and frankly, we'll make Oregon a leader, and I think we should all be proud of that. But really, the stakeholders have been very patient on this whole. This is a very complex bill, and I think we are pretty close to getting it as right as we can get it. So, thank you.
Thank you to all of you. We are in a work session, but there are two other people who would like to speak, and I'm going to give them that opportunity because we had indicated that. So, Alex Kyler from Lane County, and Lorna Walker. If you would like to come up, we would love to have you speak.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for giving me this opportunity. And I don't want to be rude, but I am also sort of on deck for a bill upstairs. So as soon as I can give this, I'm going to have to leave. Lane County is in the midst of also developing an ordinance, a local ordinance for menu labeling that is based, it's identical to the Multnomah County ordinance. And so we've been following this bill fairly closely. And the only piece of information that I'd just like to bring to your attention is the preemption. And when we testified about this bill earlier, informing the committee that we were working on our own ordinance, there was sort of a statement made that a preemption could cause us a bit of consternation. And the consternation that I'm anticipating with this Section 6 is that a local government may not adopt or enforce a local requirement for the determination or disclosure of nutritional information by a restaurant. That's been amended from initially what we saw, which was by a chain restaurant. The bill in its entirety speaks to chain restaurants, and yet now this preemption is taking that the next step further, and there has been some discussion about, a lot of discussion about what makes a chain, whether it's 15 or 20, and what about all the other restaurants that you might find in a community that also might have caloric information that people would appreciate. And this seems to me to take this a bit further than perhaps anticipated in the initial drafting of the bill, and I just wanted to bring that to your attention, that it does make it a bit of a broader statement by the legislature that a local government shall not regulate restaurants instead of just chain restaurants, as the rest of the bill speaks to, and that's my only point.
Thank you for that.
Greetings.
Oh, any questions before you ask to leave? Okay, thank you.
Chair Roblin, and my name is Lorna Walker, and I'm here at this time to raise a question regarding 2726A, which also would be complementarily related to House Bill 2982. If you look at Section 2, Number 1, in these two bills, the recommendations are that the value of calories, fat, total saturated fat, carbohydrates, and sodium are requested that those be addressed. And I will preface what I am going to say by saying that I'm not currently informed as to the technical difficulties or problems of making the assessment that I am going to recommend, nor am I knowledgeable of the cost of implementation. It's not my habit to dine out, yet there are large numbers of people who do and who might possibly benefit from being able to make a more informed choice. My suggestion is that we add in section 2, number 1, you have A, B, C, and D. I suggest that you add E and allow, as some chain restaurants do, assessment of sugar content, grams per serving. There are large numbers of people that need to be sensitive to or informed in order to be able to make a good choice. And that basically is the suggestion that I have on this. If an individual goes out and they do need to be sensitive to sugar content, a few grams of sugar per serving can make quite a lot of difference. And one of the difficulties involved with this, of course, is the fact that sugar comes in many forms, dextrose, honey, syrups, molasses, fructose, etc. And so, as I said, I'm not aware of the technical difficulties of it nor of the cost of it, but I know that some restaurants are successful in presenting this information, and compared to 20 years ago, many, many places are providing a great deal more information, which makes it much easier to go to the grocery store or out to eat and make an informed decision. And I would just recommend considering that possibility.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Any questions? Seeing none.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. And I think that as time goes on over the next number of years, there will be many considerations about the kinds of things that we get there. But for a first start, I'm really pleased with where we are. So, Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if Representative Kotak could come back up and respond to a question, but I'm just curious because I can't find it in the bill. What is the penalty to a restaurant that violates this law?
For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44. Mr. Chair and Representative Gord, thank you for the question. Primarily, as you'll notice, the enforcement is permissive. It does say may inspect. We assume a complaint-driven inspection process here if the department receives a complaint, and by relationship the local health authority that there's been a complaint that someone is not following the rules, that would initiate inspection. Section 5, if you look on page 4, Section 5, sub 2, talks about the different civil penalties related to, let's see, if the chain restaurant fails to cure the violation within 60 days, the department may impose a civil penalty of not less than $250, not more than $1,000 for the violation. We tried to choose numbers that were consistent with other public health issues in terms of restaurant inspections. The earlier bill did have, we had played with some private right of action language that was, there is no private right of action under this. The idea is not to play gotcha on the restaurants. So it's those penalties are very much in line with other inspection-oriented public health violations.
And thank you very much for that. And the only amendments we need to put in are the 24s. Is that correct?
The 24s do it all.
Okay.
And the fiscal, I believe, came back on that.
It did.
Well.
We also got the revenue, so I think we're ready to go. So,
well, thank you, colleagues.
Yes.
I like the sound of that.
Would you take
ready to go.
Would you take a motion?
I would. We're in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A24s dated 5/11/09 into House Bill 2726A.
Representative Edwards moves to adopt House Bill 2726A dash 24 amendments. Is there any discussion?
Yahoo.
Seeing none. We'll take a roll call. No, we'll just anybody disagree with those amendments? Seeing none, so ordered. Amendments are accepted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2726A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves House Bill 2726A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We do have the physical and the revenue.
We have both fiscal and revenue, which are minimal expenditure impact for the fiscal, no revenue impact for the revenue statement.
And so with that, any further discussion?
Brief comment.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank Representative Kotek for working with industry on this. Folks know that I've been lukewarm, if not outright opposed to this bill from the beginning of session. Not because I don't think that we have an out-of-control problem with obesity in the state, and not because I don't think that more information is generally a good thing, but because I question whether or not it's going to work. And really, that's all my opposition has been based on. My wife and I were blessed with a new baby daughter February 10th. And so from February 10th through about the 14th, I was held up in a room in the new hospital in Springfield, and I spent every day eating every meal for 4 days in the cafeteria there in the hospital. They have a wide assortment of food, including healthy salads, which those of you who have shared a meal with me in the House Lounge know that I fill up my plate with salad every day as in an effort to be healthier. And as I'm going through the salad line and the healthy sandwich line every day, I look over and at the fryer and the grill, I mean, it was lined up, you know, 10, 15 deep, with hospital employees, doctors and nurses, and these are folks that know that the stuff that they're eating is not healthy. You know, menu label or no menu label. So I think there's something psychological about when you're eating a meal out of your home and you're paying money for it, wanting to get that sense of value that comes with flavor. And so I'm suspect whether or not this will work. I hope that it does work, and I want to thank the representative for working this bill. I hope that it does work. I hope that I am wrong, and in 2 years we come back, and if we have some data that shows that folks are making healthier choices, then I'll be supportive of future efforts in this area as well. So,
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to build on that point a little bit. I think that it will work. I think the point of this is really giving information. Some of it might not work as well with people of our generation or older generations, but children and young people who haven't yet developed the habits of what they choose to eat are going to be empowered with information before they develop those bad habits. Last December, my family and I were traveling, and we were in Seattle, and we went to a food court in a mall in downtown Seattle, and they had already implemented their menu labeling there. And what was remarkable to me was how much that influenced the choices of what my three Well, I have four children, but my three daughters were paying attention, what they chose to eat. And the one daughter, in particular, still chose to go to the McDonald's, and she wanted to have McDonald's for lunch. But she looked at that list, and she was so surprised to learn that there was, I think it was something like a 300 or 400 calorie difference, depending on what she chose as her beverage and her side dish. And that stuck with her, that by taking the apples and the milk or the apples and some water, that it would be 300 or 400 calories less. And that information has stuck with her if she's eaten fast food later, and she talks about the calories that are in fries or the calories that are in a soda. So I think that the benefits of this aren't just for those of us today or next year that go to a restaurant and see what's on the menu. It's really in the impact of having this information available to young people as they're learning how to order, and they'll start making healthier choices. And I've seen it work with my kids, so I'm looking forward to seeing this available here rather than having to drive to Seattle to do that.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to clarify why I'll be voting yes, because I explained why what I didn't like about the bill, but I'm about to vote yes. And so I just wanted to make it clear that it's clear that there are several counties, if not at least two, that want to do this. You know, and so I think it is better policy to have a more uniform state standard than a smattering of local policies all over the state. And so for that reason, I will be voting for the bill. So.
And I guess what I will say has to do with being a type 2 diabetic. It is really nice to have the general numbers to make some decisions. If you're going to be eat bad, I might choose to do that in the restaurant, but it just means that I have to do much, much better other places. And those people with diabetes, they know themselves, and they know what ranges they can get into without getting themselves in too much trouble usually. Having these kind of numbers, these general numbers with the calories and the carbohydrates can be very helpful in that kind of stuff. So I am pleased that we're moving where we are. Yes, Representative Girard.
Just a final comment. I share some of Representative Edwards' concerns about whether it'll work, plus what's this going to do to the French fry industry. I mean, this is really going to hurt, and potatoes come from my neck of the woods.
And with that, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Nay.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. And Gelser, did you? No, I think. I just had to say that. We'll have Representative. Oh, you would like to? Okay. No. Representative Kotek will carry this bill.
Thank you.
We have an open work session already on House Bill. Let's see which one I wanted to get to. Yeah. 2345, and we have one person that has to testify before 4:30, so yes. We didn't do the one. We just did the
24. Just did the 24. What? We just did the 24. They only passed the 24.
Oh, yes, we know they're doing this one, too.
And 2345.
Yeah, they do.
So the dash 5 is fine, but the dash 6
got it.
Needs to be.
So with that, we have a number of people that want to testify, so we will call up Andrea Meyer, because she has a schedule to make.
Thank you.
And then Dennis Johnson could come up, and Alex Jubler as well, if they would like.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for letting me come out of order, and I appreciate it. I brought this up because I've been working on fingerprint criminal history background checks since I've been in this building for 10 years, but since 2005, I think this is my file, and the product in 2005 was a 65-page bill, and we do have concerns with the portion of Section 1A before you regarding criminal history background checks. Just in brief, we when you are arrested, there's a fingerprint taken of you, but what we are talking about is the broad authority we now give licensing boards, department agencies to do what we call a criminal history FBI fingerprint background check to determine whether someone has a criminal history and then to do a fitness determination for employment or licensing purposes. In doing that and in working on that legislation with a lot of stakeholders over the years, one of the critical pieces is that we do not retain fingerprints of people who are innocent and never been convicted of a crime. Indeed, in our statutes, ORS 181.534 and elsewhere, we make it explicitly clear that we will not send our fingerprints in these cases to the FBI unless they have a policy to destroy or return and not keep a copy, and likewise Oregon State Police to return and or destroy and not keep a copy. ACLU has not been involved in this legislation because until the amendments were adopted in 2345 with the addition of this section regarding having someone provide their fingerprints and be retained in the lead system, we do not have any issues with the underlying legislation. You do have before you the dash 5s and dash 6s, both of which I believe were prepared at the request of Representative Greenlick, not to speak to their position at all. The dash 5s are amendments that the ACLU would support because it removes on page 2, lines 15 through 25. you'll probably hear testimony, and unfortunately I can't stay, but the dash sixes remove page on line 2, remove lines 20 to 23 and do not remove a part of the issue about which we have concern, which is the fingerprints, and we would respectfully request that the committee move with the dash 5s. We have no issue with the remainder of the dash 6s as they relate to page 3 and onward. And as to the dash 5s, there's one change to page 4, and it's not our issue, and it may very well be in dash 6s. But what the dash 6s would still leave in is the licensee consents to the entry of the licensee's name and fingerprints in the LEDS system. I mean, the LEDS system, while it's gotten a little bit out of control, is generally a criminal history database. And this is not the authority needed to send them to the FBI, because that, and this is appears to be retaining the names and fingerprints in the LEDS system. And there may be some argument for this in terms of what they're trying to put together. I would simply urge that at this point in the session and this very complicated issue, that we just remove that from the bill and move forward. I think there's a requirement that people would have to notify if they've been arrested or convicted. And you've got a lot of important underlying policies here, and I would be so happy if ACLU were removed entirely from this bill and we were to leave the criminal history FBI LEDS fingerprint issue alone in this legislation. Thank you. I am happy to answer any questions.
I'll just ask one because I know you have to go. So the 5s and the 6s are not consistent. So if we adopted them both, we'd have a problem.
Chair Roble, members of the committee, yes, I think two different folks were behind it, so I don't know that. I don't think it was an intentional, but it is.
So if we, from your perspective, if we just accepted the 5s, you're okay with the rest, but you're not talking about the rest of the policy.
Chair Roble, that is correct, and I know that if the dash 6s have some concerns still with some of the stakeholders, OMA and others, that need to be worked on the Senate side. I'd be so most appreciative, though, if the ACLU concerns could be addressed on the House side, and I would be lovely to exit stage right on this issue. But if the dash 6s are adopted, that still leaves a really big problem for us.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for her before she has to leave? I think you're okay.
Thank you. I appreciate the courtesy today.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair Roland, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Dennis Johnson. I'm with the Oregon Dental Association. I'm currently secretary treasurer of that organization. And it's the ODA's position that we are firmly against this bill 2345A. The Board of Dentistry already has an effective diversion and monitoring program in place that is incredibly cost effective. Basically, the Board of Dentistry has informed the ODA that the cost to implement this particular bill in terms of for just dentists is between $50,000 to $70,000 a year to invest in a program that the dentistry as a profession already has a program in place through the board. We would certainly be more happy to if this was to be implemented, we would ask that it be made a pilot program and pick the board that is having a problem with their diversion program and apply it to them. At present, there's absolutely no problem with the monitoring and diversion program that the Board of Dentistry is running very, very cost effectively. And I participated in 10 years of advocation for the board's program that's actually done by an administrative rule, and it's working very, very well. I think to step on and this for this legislation to disband currently operating diversion and monitoring programs would be a travesty, and that's the position of the ODA.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
We'll keep you for a second and have this other person testify, and then we'll ask questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee members. Excuse me. My name is Alicia Duber, and I represent my father, John Avery, who was murdered in a nursing home. I say the word murdered because that's what happened. He was lethally overdosed by a nurse in 1998. That's a long time ago. But the problems that pertain to him and what happened in that nursing home, in my opinion and in the opinion of others, it still goes on to this day. You just don't know about it. It took a nurse to report it to me for me to find out about it, and then it's taken years, and that's starting immediately with the Board of Nursing, please help me, what happened, fix this, to then in 04 I started when not getting any other help from the judicial system with the legislature coming here. So now it's 09, it's 5 years later, and finally a bill has come forward that addresses the issue, which in my opinion, I respect what this gentleman just said. I don't know that all boards need to have their monitoring programs changed. I can only address the Board of Nursing. It's the only board I dealt with, and it's the only board that for many years did not do their job of protecting the public in any way, shape, or form. I will say that now since 06 and some publicity that hit the board, there's been more information about what went on within the board. A couple of executives were fired, and now I highly praise the executive director, Holly Mercer, for the work that she's doing. And I say the Board of Nursing should not be monitoring their own people. It's like, as Senator Avell Gordley said, it's like the fox in the hen house when she was looking at presenting a bill strictly on the Board of Nursing of taking the monitoring program out. The gentleman who did what he did to my father and four other people was not in the monitoring program, but he should have been because of his history. Nobody was monitoring him. And some can say that's 11 years ago, it's not the same anymore. I don't know that to be true. Nobody can prove that to me because there's no place to go to get help if there is a problem. Many public people that I've talked with have said, nobody cares, nobody will do anything, you might as well give up. He was an old man anyway. And that is totally, totally irresponsible of a board, a state board. So as you can tell, I'm very firm in my opinion. I believe the monitoring program should definitely come out of the Board of Nursing. Should it come out of other boards, I have no idea. And I know this bill covers many boards. So if it takes changing all the boards, then I'm sorry. So be it. The nurse monitoring program, or impaired professional, it's now called, needs to be monitored by someone other than the board. Thank you. And I didn't have written testimony because I was not sure what was happening today. And I'm just a lay folk. I have not a professional. All I know is it's been 11 years I've been fighting for my dad, and I can't wait for the day when finally the state fights for him too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've done a great job of expressing your feelings and your beliefs, so I appreciate that. Any questions for these people here, these witnesses? Thank you very much. Thank you for being here,
both of you.
Karen Wheeler, Bruce Bishop, and Holly Mercer. And with that, whatever order, but as I call them, I guess Bruce gets to be first.
Actually, you called me second.
Did I? Okay. Or Karen was first, I guess, wasn't it? Go ahead, Karen.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Program Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2345, the A and Gross version, and I do have a comment about the amendments. In consultation with the Governor's Office, Representative Maurer's office, and as well as Representative Greenlick's office, we support the amendment that removes the requirement to have people's fingerprints retained. This policy was not included in the governor's budget, so I'm not commenting on the fiscal impact of the bill, but we are supportive of the concept. Addictions and mental health disorders are chronic illnesses, chronic conditions. Health professionals affected by these illnesses need treatment. They need monitoring and supervision to ensure that their patients receive the highest quality health care. The Addictions and Mental Health Division supports the creation of a standardized impaired health professionals program to provide the monitoring and supervision of healthcare professionals during their treatment. I understand that the current status regarding health impaired impaired health professionals is that there is not a centralized program or standardized guidelines for these programs. The Addictions and Mental Health Division is uniquely positioned and qualified to carry out the functions of an impaired health professionals program. AMH is the lead state entity responsible for coordinating, assisting, and directing community mental health and addiction services. It is our job to understand the nature of addiction and mental health disorders and to keep abreast of the most recent state-of-the-art treatments and associated systems that work together to help people achieve recovery. Transitioning responsibility for the monitoring function from the various health licensing boards to AMH will take some time and also will require some careful consideration and planning. AMH will work with the health professional licensing boards to design a high-quality, effective program to be implemented on July 1, 2010. A transition and implementation planning committee will convene immediately after the bill passes to begin working on a transition strategy to move the responsibilities for monitoring licensees from the boards to DHS. And I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Bruce.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of Northwest Permanente, the medical group associated with Kaiser Permanente, which includes approximately 1,000 physicians serving Kaiser Permanente enrollees in the metropolitan area of Portland and Salem. First of all, let me say that I submitted written testimony to you, but the written testimony refers to the Dash 2 amendments, which were considered in the House Healthcare Committee, but then they adopted another set of amendments, and frankly, I haven't had a chance to read those amendments. I understand that your committee today has some additional amendments, one set of which I was handed as I approached the witness stand, so I haven't been able to fully integrate those amendments into the bill. I think it's important to recognize, however, that this bill has not had a full hearing in the House Healthcare Committee. I know that's going to be an imposition on this committee to work through all of the issues that the bill may present, but unfortunately, I think that is your obligation at this point. And in our view, there are a number of significant policy issues in House Bill 2345 that need to be addressed. I would hope that this committee would not just pass the bill on to the Senate in the expectation that the Senate would fix the issues that remain in the bill. In my written testimony, I identified a number of technical issues that we think exist in the bill the way it's crafted. Perhaps the best way for me to demonstrate to you those complications is to refer to a chart that I picked up this afternoon at the hearing. And I can't tell you whose chart it is, but it was on the table as if it's an exhibit that somebody submitted to you.
Yep.
And the problem I have with this chart is I think it may be an accurate description of what the bill does. It strikes me that it is not a useful description of a process on which a program can be built. And the specific concern I have is that this chart and the bill, as far as I can tell, presumes that licensees will sign a diversion agreement. It is that diversion agreement that is at the core of what this bill tries to accomplish. And I can't tell from the bill how that's supposed to happen. It may be that the licensing boards are supposed to start an investigation and take action against a licensee, which then triggers a diversion agreement, and then actions happen after that. I don't think the bill draft the bill in front of you, whether it's the A engrossed or the subsequent amendments to it, actually describe how that process is going to happen. There are a number of significant procedural issues, I believe, in the way the bill is crafted, that will not result in a adequately operating program to help licensees who are impaired by alcohol and drug abuse or by mental illness. That's what this bill is about. I don't think this bill achieves its purpose. The concern that Northwest Permanente has is that the Oregon Medical Board has what we believe to be a successful program for treating licensees. This bill proposes to throw that program away. It repeals the statutes under which that program has operated for 20 years. And I believe on or about January 1st, 2010, maybe the date's later now, there will be a new program that's consolidating all of the programs that currently exist. We don't even believe there's a transition process identified in this bill for licensees who are currently in treatment before this bill takes effect. So we're very concerned about the effect that this legislation would have on licensees who are already in treatment before the new provisions kick in and what the transition plan is to be for them. I'm not going to detail all of the technical issues that I've identified. Some of that is because the references don't jive with the bill you have in front of you, and I'll be glad to reconcile the testimony so that they do. But suffice it to say at this point, we don't believe that, based on our reading of the bill, it accomplishes its purpose. We think there will be substantial unintended consequences from this effort to improve operations of the impaired professionals programs for the health professions. And for those reasons, we would strongly recommend that the committee not adopt the bill as it's currently before you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And with that, Holly Mercer, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Holly Mercer. I'm the executive director of the State Board of Nursing. I've only been in my position a year. When I came into the agency in January of 2008, we had gone through a major transformation. We licensed 70,000 individuals in this state, including nurses, certified nurse assistants, and advanced practice nurses. 50,000 of those licenses would come within this type of program. This program does not pertain to certified nurse assistants. It is only for registered nurses and advanced practice nurses and licensed practical nurses. We have the largest health professional impaired program among the licensing boards. Our program usually runs about 280 individuals. When I joined the agency in January of 2008, even after going through a year or more of publicity about our program and about the Board of Nursing, we uncovered additional problems within our nurse monitoring program. I don't disagree at all with Alicia Juber's recommendation that these programs come out from under the licensing boards. We believe that it is in the interest of public safety to have a standardized program, and we can spend many, many more months and years finding some technical problems with this type of bill. But basically what this bill is trying to do, and I have great faith in the work group as I was on with Representative Maurer, we can work through those deficiencies. We can find a solution. The problem here is public safety, and the public deserves a consistent, standardized approach to this very, very difficult and sometimes unmanageable type of disease process. What we're trying to do is return these career professionals back to their profession. And I believe that the public deserves a consistent, standardized approach. And we believe the way to do that is to take those programs out from under the licensing boards and move it into one umbrella program so that we have the same kind of consistent standards. I would be happy to answer any questions of the committee. It is my first legislative session, so I've not met many of you. But we do, I feel, have a stronger program now than we did a year ago, but we still have a ways to go. And I am more than willing to address any problems that any of the other boards would like to discuss, any other public members would like to discuss, but I believe it's time for this program to shift out from underneath the boards.
Thank you very much. Questions for any of these witnesses? I will note that on more than a couple of occasions we have heard great testimony about Holly Mercer and the work you're doing on the nursing board. So from a representative who's just watching and not been on the health committees, I appreciate the work you've been doing over the last year.
Thank you, sir. Chairman, I would also like to say that part of that is being transparent and not being defensive about our programs. And I think that, of course, I think all other boards kind of look to the Board of Nursing as causing a lot of this, you know, scrutiny. But we have learned a great deal, and we have a stronger program. But I also think that we have learned for other boards and for the public in general, this is an extremely important issue for public safety. Thank you. Thanks for your comments.
And the final person on the list is Mike Crew from the Oregon Medical Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Crew. I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. I have worked on the same work group as Representative Maurer, trying to get a bill that makes some sense out of this HPP program that we're dealing with here today. And very briefly, we believe that on the Senate side, I don't think you're going to be able to get it done here, but on the Senate side, we've got to reconcile the Dash 5s with the Dash 6s as it relates to the LEDS program. And we've talked to the governor's office about that, and Claudia Black has said that will happen. And we have a conceptual amendment that we want, and I might just add that under the current HPP program for the Oregon Medical Board, we have a self-referral program that works. And the bill is drafted, envisions a self-referral program, and conceptually we want to make it clear that that self-referral program will remain, and we can clarify it on the Senate side as some concerns we have. Representative Maurer has said that will happen, as well as the governor's office. So with that, we just wanted to be of record that we expect that this bill will be further clarified on the Senate side.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate what you've said. Why not on the House side?
Frankly, because we only saw these amendments at roughly 3 o'clock, and we haven't had time. We would love to get it done on this side, frankly. We would rather get it done and then see the bill move if time permitted, but we understood this bill was going to move today. That's why.
Thank you for that. We don't have the fiscal or the revenue, so we're going to put the work session over until Wednesday at least. Right now, my druthers, and I'll let the group here have this feeling, I am interested in moving the Dash 5 so we can get that portion cleared up. And at that point, then, I do think that the week or so it's going to take to move across the building will give the work group some more time to get the Dash 6s in line with that. And do the things that you're talking about. And I see Representative Maurer here. So you want to come up, Representative Maurer? We'll leave you over there to figure that one. But we would love, I think there's been a lot of work on this bill. I think that personally, getting it under one organization is a good idea. I think the work that's been done has gotten us quite a ways along here. And that's kind of where I'm feeling right now. But we'll talk with the committee members between now and then. So thank you for your testimony. So I'm going to close the work set, the public hearing on House Bill 2345A. And we will move the work session over to Wednesday. We hope by then we'll have the the revenue and the physical back on both of those amendments. We'll have that conversation then, but currently I don't think the two work together well. If there was a way to get something to happen, we might be able to get that even by then, so we'll give them some little bit of time if they want to do that too. Yes?
Mr. Chair, having read both the Dash 5 and the Dash 6 amendment, it looks to me like they are in conflict. I would be happy to support the Dash 5 as is, as you suggested. So it would seem to me that we might want to propose to the proponents of the Dash 6 that they should revise that to either incorporate the Dash 5 or make something that can be adopted simultaneously with the Dash 5 instead of in conflict with the Dash 5.
Yeah, I would entertain that as well. So, thank you. So, did we already close the... Yeah, we did.
You closed
the hearing.
And we moved the
You're
other...
holding the work session over.
Yeah. So, with that, we have another session that... public hearing that's open. That's on House Bill 3104. And we do have a couple of people who are here to testify for that. So, Kate Newall and Paula Brown, if you're still with us, we'd love to have you. Anytime I can keep Kate here is great.
Ways and Means? The Veterans?
Has a referral to Ways and Means?
Yes. Yes, this one here. Yeah, I agree. We don't have the revenue, so we'll have to suspend the rules, but we can do that. So...
Members of the committee, Chair Roblin, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall. I'm here today with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3104 and the Dash 5 amendments. And I'm just going to be actually really brief in my testimony today. We believe that this bill and the governor's recent executive order are very complementary measures, both to better identify, reach out to, and get services to veterans in Oregon who may benefit from resources that they don't even know exist for them. I think this bill requires a very simple step for agencies like BOLI that could have a tremendous impact for veterans who oftentimes don't know that there are services out there that they may qualify for. As a state agency that interacts with tens of thousands of clients each year, we support doing this very simple effort, such as creating a link on our website to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to better spread the word among veterans about those available services. And we also support distributing to our clients, where it is feasible and appropriate, printed materials provided by the Oregon Department of Veterans Associations. And we think that this will be a very effective measure to get that information out to veterans. BOLI also looks forward to creating partnerships with the local governments, school districts, and other community organizations to help implement additional and similar efforts to get this material out to veterans. Again, we're happy to be here today in support of House Bill 3104 and the Dash 5 amendments. We do believe that this is a very simple step. We are excited and honored to be a part of it and look forward to better connecting veterans with services and resources that they may benefit from. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I guess we'll hear from both of you, and then we'll have some questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and so that I'm not boring you by reading my testimony or by repeating what Paul Evans talked about earlier, or Representative Nathanson. They covered some very good points. They made some very good points. I will direct you to the paragraph that's near the bottom. The person that testified just before me talked about the potential impact and return on that investment, and I would like to point out that for every general fund dollar that the department spends in assisting veterans, and Oregon veterans receive $182 back. So if we take a look at the return on investment, that return on investment is very good. And if we take a look at the numbers, if only 25% of the 270,000 veterans who we currently are not in contact with and are not receiving benefits, that could potentially be a return on that investment of $1 billion to the state of Oregon. That's a good return for the veteran, and that's very helpful to the local communities because those veterans then take those dollars and expend them in the local communities. We're very thankful that these state agencies want to be our partners. They want to take a look at ways that they can help us connect with those veterans, and we're excited to see the outcome of this and then report that back to the legislature as well. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony. You have my written testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for either of these witnesses? Thank you both.
Thank you.
We're going to hear a short explanation because when our representatives came earlier, we didn't have it of the dash fives, very shortly from our administrator. And we don't have the revenue, but it's going to Ways and Means. It has a subsequent referral. So if I will, after we get down, I'm probably going to ask for a suspension of the rules to allow us to send it. So with that.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, the proposed House Bill 3104-5 amendments replace the original measure. It requires the Department of Veterans Affairs to establish a website that allows members of the public to request information about veterans' benefits and services and enter contact information. It requires the department to coordinate outreach to persons who request information. It directs the department to report before October 1 of each even-numbered year to the appropriate legislative interim committees on the department's outreach to veterans. Requires state agencies, as defined in ORS 183.310, to include on an agency's website a link to the website established in this act. Directs the department to provide agencies and county governments, that's the Department of Veterans Affairs, to provide agencies and county governments with printed informational materials on how to request information about veterans' benefits. Requires agencies and county governments to make that information available in offices accessible to the public, and to make reasonable efforts to provide information to customers or clients during face-to-face contacts. Finally, it requires agency directors to prepare a report to the appropriate interim committees of the Legislative Assembly on the effectiveness of measures taken to implement provisions that are applicable to state agencies.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3104, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3104. And I would entertain a motion to suspend the rules for the purpose of...
The purposes of what?
Sending
you want to
the...
First amend it?
Pardon?
You want to first amend
oh, yeah,
it?
We should first amend.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 5 amendment stated 5609 in House Bill 3104. Is that what you're looking at?
Yes.
The dash
5? Yep. Okay. Representative Edwards moves that the amendments to House Bill... 3104, the dash 5 amendments. Any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. And there was a question, since it doesn't cost anymore, we haven't got the referral taken off, so that's why it's going to Ways and Means. We could ask for that. Because the fiscal came back as...
Well, we don't have the fiscal.
Or the revenue.
I thought we didn't have the revenue.
I guess we have both, neither one, so we'll have to add.
No. Which one are we doing right now?
3104.
We have the revenue. Revenue impact, but the fiscal.
Oh, it's the fiscal we don't have. Sorry about that. Yep. It's the fiscal we don't have.
We
have the revenue.
Yes, we have
the revenue. With the dash fives?
Yes. Dash five revenue?
We have the dash five revenue.
Yes. Okay. So I will suspend the rules with respect so that we can send the bill as amended to Ways and Means without the fiscal statement.
So moved.
Okay. Isn't that what we have to do? Yes. So Representative Edwards moves that we suspend the rules so that we can make a motion to send this amended bill to Ways and Means without the physical statement. I guess that's how it goes. Any discussion on this one? I guess it's not really debatable. Any opposition? Yes.
The amendment requires the department to create a website, which costs some money.
Right.
It also requires every department to add information to their website.
Correct. Ah, here we go. This is from DAS, yes.
I'd be comfortable with this if we could have, you know, bigger than a bread box kind of
discussion.
Order of magnitude without the precise fiscal. But if we're talking about a $10 million item, I'm uncomfortable.
Chair Roblin and Representative Nolan, for the record, my name is Marjorie Taylor. I'm the legislative coordinator for DAS. And we've had the opportunity to work with Paul Evans and ODVA on this precise issue, and DAS is ready, willing, and able to have one icon that will be loaded onto every agency webpage that will link directly to the information that ODVA has. And we We work with them specifically on the date of implementation so that we can get that all up and running by October. So it's just one link that any person viewing any state agency website will see that. If they're a veteran, they can click on it. It will go to the ODBA website.
Right. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So then, Ms. Taylor, are we likely to be looking at a minimal fiscal impact?
Chair Roblin and Representative Nolan, my understanding is that there shouldn't be a fiscal impact from the agencies on this unless it comes from ODBA, and my understanding is that they won't have a fiscal impact on that. Because, again, the Department of Administrative Services will work with all agencies so that this one link will appear on everybody's website, and then the additional communication would come from ODBA with their postcards that agencies will be able to distribute to the public.
Mr. Chair, could I see a nodding head from ODBA? Great. Fine. I'm good.
Okay. So, any other discussion about suspending the rules so that we can send this to Ways and Means?
We're sending it to Ways and Means, not to
Yes. Yeah. It has a subsequent referral. We haven't taken that off. Okay.
With that, is there any way to...
Is there any objection to suspending the rules right now? Seeing none.
Nope.
So ordered. So, is there... We can wait. When we get this fiscal back, if in fact then the speaker wants to take it off, they can. That possibly could be done by Wednesday. So the question is, do we want to move the bill today and send it to Ways and Means, or do we want to wait and see if we get a no physical back and ask for it to be removed? Question of this group. Yes.
I don't have a problem with waiting, and this isn't an issue with this bill. I just want to raise again the inconsistency of the information that we're getting about websites, and it seems like it is rather arbitrary, and if somebody decides they want something to move, a website and a database are free, and if they don't, they cost hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. And at some point, I would like Ways and Means to have the opportunity to weigh the issue of what the cost of databases and website updates are, because I think that I think we have some inequity in the way that we're moving forward as a number of bills relate to one another in this issue of it's just a link, it's just a small database, it's just an Excel sheet. It makes no sense to me, and it continues to deeply trouble me.
Representative Gelser, I think, argues for sending it to Ways and Means.
I will take a motion.
Mr. Do you want to send it with recommendation, right?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3104 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Correct. No. It says that, actually.
We've got all sorts of procedures for sending it to...
Representative
Edwards. You want me to retract my...
No, it's okay. Representative Edwards moves that...
he'll just tell you what you really
said. Right, exactly. that we send House Bill 3104 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be sent to Ways and Means by prior reference. It does say to the House to that floor.
That's how the motion always goes.
With
to the floor with
yeah.
the due pass recommendation
right.
that it go to Ways and Means by
you
prior reference.
Right. Yep. Great. Yep. That's the motion on the floor. Any discussion?
Good.
Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Yes.
Representative Jensen?
Yeah.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excuse?
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye.
Motion
passes. Okay. Now, we do have one bill left, but we have no time left. And she's been waiting here so patiently that what I'm going to do, we had it set up for a possible public hearing, possible work session. We've done everything we can on this bill, so I am going to put it forward to Wednesday with just a work session, and we will put it as the first thing, and this time we'll actually do it the first. If there hadn't been so many representatives coming with each of their bills today, we would have been earlier. But I appreciate both of you being here and being so patient, and I apologize for that, but we will take care of this bill on Wednesday. Thank you. Any other business to come before our committee? Seeing none, I'm going to close the work session that I opened a little second ago on 3104. I'll close that. And now I'll close the House Rules Committee's today's actions. Thank you.